Good morning once again.
Good morning.
We continue in our lessons on predestination. This will be number 55. We continue under the title of the Battle of the Cross, and this will be part 9. Be turning with me for our text today in the book of Luke, chapter 23 and verses 4 through 20. As we continue to try to what we're calling flesh out the doctrine of sovereignty, election, and predestination to show it from Genesis all the way through the book of Revelation, that it is impossible to believe that God has an eternal purpose or goal that he is going to achieve without holding to the doctrine of sovereign predestination. Follow along with me in Luke chapter 23, verse 4, as we continue in the section on the civil trial of Christ. So Pilate said to the chief priest and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." But they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." And when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. And then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. And then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. And that very day Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with each other. Then Pilate, when he had called the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him, for it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast." And they all cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion in the city and for murder." Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them. Now, in our last lesson, we covered the first phase of the Roman civil trial before Pilate. And the goal of the Jewish leaders was to prove that Jesus was guilty of insurrection against the Roman nation. And the charges were 3 in number, but none of them could be proven. An extensive conversation occurred between Pilate and Jesus over the nature of his kingship. And when Jesus, though, made it clear that his kingdom was not a political kingdom, but a kingdom of moral truth, then Pilate was satisfied that Jesus was no threat to the Roman government. And Pilate then confronted the Jewish leaders with his verdict in verse 4, "I find no fault in this man." Now let's examine today Christ's civil trials before Pilate and heaven and Herod. This will be the second and third phases of the civil trials. First, before Herod. This is covered in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 23, verses 4 through 17, of which we have read already. Follow with me in verse 5. There we have the Jewish response to Pilate's verdict. The Jews violently objected to Pilate's verdict by taking another approach. They wanted Pilate to be aware of the extent to which Jesus' ministry had covered. It was not just a small, localized thing residing only in Jerusalem, but it covered all of Judea and Galilee. And they particularly mentioned Galilee because there had been several insurrections occurring there, primarily from the groups known as the Zealots. And they wanted Pilate to know that if he did not dispose of Jesus, he might lose control of those areas and lose his job. Verses 6 and 7. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he jumped at the chance of not having to settle the issue in his court. Like a hot potato, I'm going to get rid of this. King Herod was the one who had jurisdiction over Galilee. So he sent Jesus over to Herod's court. If you want to glance at your chart while you follow the steps, you'll see it's very closely located. And Herod happened to be in Jerusalem at that time for the feast. So it would be like going to a location close at hand. And the chart that you have shows the close proximity by following the footprints number 5, if you can. You see those on your chart. Verses 8 and 9 now tell us that Herod was glad to meet Jesus, in that he had heard about him, but that he had never met him. Let's consider a little bit about the history of the life of Herod. His name was Antipas. Herod was his title, Herod Antipas. And he was one of several sons of Herod the Great. Herod the Great was made king of Judea by the Roman Senate in B.C. 40 and died in B.C. 4. He was the king who attempted to kill Jesus in his infancy, as recorded in the book of Matthew, the 2nd chapter. And when he died, then his kingdom was divided among his sons. And Herod Antipas was given authority over Galilee and Perisia, over which he ruled from B.C. 4 to A.D. 39. Now get that long count there. This is during the life of Jesus. And yet he's never met Jesus. Never had any charge that has ever been brought up before him that Jesus was an insurrectionist in any time throughout his life here on earth. And with the exception of the accounts of Jesus' birth, Antipas is the Herod who appears in the gospel records of Christ's life and ministry. Now, Antipas married the daughter of Aretas IV. And this marriage was designed by Rome for political purposes. But while visiting his half-brother, Herod Philip I, in Rome, Antipas had an affair with Philip's wife, whose name was Herodias. And she was not only Philip's wife, but she was Antipas's niece. Thus, the affair was not only adulterous, it was incestuous. Did I get that right? Okay. She agreed to leave her husband Philip and marry Antipas on the condition that he divorce the daughter of Aretas. It was for this unlawful divorce and marriage to his brother's wife that John the Baptist rebuked Antipas. And this provoked the wrath of Herodias, who eventually had John the Baptist beheaded in Luke 14, verses 3 through 11. Now, three events occurred in the life of Jesus which were related to Herod Antipas. They were first. The first came shortly after the death of John the Baptist. It's found in the Gospel of Luke, if you want to turn there quickly, chapter 9, verses 7 through 9, where we read these words. Now Herod the Tetrarch heard of all that was done by him, And he was perplexed, because it was said by some that John had risen from the dead, and by some that Elijah had appeared, and by others that one of the old prophets had risen again. And Herod said, John I have beheaded, but who is this of whom I hear such things? So he sought to see him. That's the first relation that Herod had with Jesus. The second occurred in Luke chapter 13. Turn over there, verses 31 through 33, where we read, On that very day some Pharisees came, saying to him, Get out and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you. And he said to them, Go tell that fox, Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. Nevertheless, I must journey today, tomorrow, and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside of Jerusalem. The third incident in which connects Herod Antipas with Jesus is the one that is recorded here that we are looking at today, where Jesus is sent to Herod. So Jesus will have three reference points with Herod. Now this helps us to understand here in Luke 23 and verses 8 through 12. Why there are two reasons now why Herod Antipas was, quote, exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him. They were, first reason, he had heard many things about him. And the second reason, he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Not only will Jesus not do a miracle, he won't even talk to him. Jesus said, there's only one sign I'm going to give, and that's the sign of the prophet Jonas. And he refused even to communicate with Herod. Verses 9 and 10, Luke 23, tell us that Antipas questioned Jesus extensively about matters of which we're not told. Jesus refused to even talk to him. Meanwhile, the Jewish leaders had followed Jesus to Herod's court and continued to make their accusations against him. Jesus' refusal to talk to Antipas may have been because of Herod's interest in seeing a miracle rather than dealing with the main issue of insurrection. But in so doing, he was fulfilling the prophecy found in Isaiah 53:7. Why did Jesus not talk to Herod? Isaiah 53:7, he was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. This is but another example of the future being foreordained as certain to occur long before it occurs. In other words, whenever you have a prophecy, it is a prediction of something that is to happen in the future, and it is certain to occur. And that is foreordination. Verse 11 now. Herod concludes that he's dealing with a clown, not an insurrectionist, and begins to make fun of Jesus. He places a royal garment of a king upon Jesus and sends him back to Pilate. And in so doing, he is declaring that Jesus is innocent of the Jewish charges and presents no danger to Rome. It's noteworthy, as I've mentioned previously, that Jesus lived his life primarily under the reign of Herod Antipas, and yet he had never been considered a threat to Rome, even though Antipas had had to deal with many Jewish insurrections. Verse 12, Luke adds a footnote here that Herod and Pilate, quote, became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with each other. Matthew Henry observes, quote, They had been at enmity between themselves, probably upon Pilate's killing the Galileans, who were Herod's subjects, as recorded in Luke 13:1, or some other such matter of controversy as usually occurs among princes and great men. Observe how those that quarreled with one another yet could unite against Christ. Christ is the great peacemaker. Both Pilate and Herod owned his innocency, and their agreeing in this cured their disagreeing in other things. End of quote. Now Jesus goes back before Pilate, and you can see the little steps leading back to Pilate's judgment hall on your chart. And this is seen in Luke 23, verses 13 through 14, in John 18, 39 through 40, and 19, 1 through 16. In Luke 23:13, a note, it begins the phase of the three-phase civil trial. How many phases were there in the ecclesiastical trial? Remember, three. Three in the civil trial. And this combined, this last phase with the three phases of the ecclesiastical trial means that Jesus has been through six trials in just a few hours. Think of that. No sleep. So combine this with the events of the Passover meal and those in the garden, and one sees how long he has gone without sleep. This combined with the stress involved, and one can see how much energy is already being drawn from the body of Jesus before he is ever scourged or taken away to be crucified. In verses 13 through 17, Pilate explains that neither he nor Herod were able to find any evidence which would make Jesus guilty of engaging in insurrection against Rome. So he stated that while Jesus was not deserving of a death sentence, he would nevertheless punish him and release him to the Jews to try to show the Jews, well, here's your piece of flesh. He's been punished. However, a custom had been arranged to release a guilty Jewish prisoner each year at the time of the Passover feast, and this was designed to help calm relations with the Jews and the Romans. In verses 18 and 19, we have the Jewish response. They did not want Jesus released, but a man named Barabbas, who had been found guilty of insurrection and murder under Roman law. The tension is mounting now in Pilate's life as he is being caught in a dilemma. How can he, as a judge, crucify an innocent man, set free a guilty man, and uphold the Roman system of judgment at the same justice at the same time? He is caught in a vice. While Pilate is trying to decide what to do, he receives a note from his wife. If it would have been in today's thing, why, the cell phone would have rang and say, wait a minute, I want to talk to you about something. Now, this is while the trial's going on now. You can imagine that Pilate would have said, don't interrupt me, I've got important things. Here his wife sends a note. This is recorded in Matthew 27:19, where we read, while he, Pilate, was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him. End of quote. So she's saying, don't you do anything to harm this man. I've had a dream, and he's a just man. He's innocent. Now Pilate is getting hit from all sides. His wife says, let the man alone and release him. But we read in Matthew 27:20 that something else was happening among the Jewish element. Quote, "But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus." Now what's happening? A mob-like mentality is now developing. A riot could soon break out, which could cost Pilate his job, if not his very life, at the hands of his Roman superiors. Up until now, it has been primarily the Jewish leaders which have been doing the accusation, but now they've been successful in gathering a large group of the people. And remember, we got tens of thousands of people here in Jerusalem for the feast. And initially, why, when Jesus rode into Jerusalem, why, it was hail to the king, so forth, and they were all for him. But now then, there's a group that is turning against him due to the influence of the Jewish leaders. Pilate was responsible for maintaining order in his province. Now, in comparing the chronological order of this account as given in the four Gospels, we must now go over to John chapter 19, verses 1 through 16. I must say that either due to my aging mind or other factors, this series of lessons that I'm in right now have been the most difficult to bring in all of my 52 years of ministry. Why so? Because you have to follow a chronological order, and the Gospels are not given. Some things say this, some say that. In fact, if it were not for John, we wouldn't even know that Jesus was sent to Herod. The other three Gospels don't record that. And so you've got to try to sandwich all of these events in and put a place in here and then drop out here and come over to this gospel. And then after you're through there, have to go back to another gospel to get all of this put together. And that's mind-bending. Now in John chapter 19, verses 1 through 8, we read, "So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head. And they put on him a purple robe. And then they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again." Remember, he's going in and out of the courtroom. Why won't the Jews come into the courtroom? They think it's defiled, and it will make them unclean to eat of the Passover. So Pilate goes back out, says, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him." And then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." You can see the disgust and the disdain that Pilate has for the Jewish people and their system. And the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid. I don't have this in my notes, but this ought to settle with the preponderance of evidence against those who hold that Jesus never claimed to be God. And that is made in the camp of the liberals. It's made in the camp of the Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jews did not understand it that way. When they referred that title to him, the Son of God, they say that is guilt, that is him claiming to be God, and that's blasphemy. So Christ then claimed to be the Son of God, and his opponents believed that's what he does, and that's why he was crucified. Now in John 19:1-3, it's hard for me to read this. Pilate scourged Jesus, and the soldiers put a crown of thorns on his head, a purple robe on him, and then they mocked him by ascribing royal honor to him. They would line up and come before him and bow and pay homage to the king. And this was followed by slapping him. And the Gospel of Mark says that they would then spit on him. And this occurred inside the courtroom while the Jews remained outside. This was being done by Pilate's soldiers. Now, since Pilate could not appease the Jews by offering Barabbas in Christ's place, he decides to inflict punishment upon Jesus, which would be short of death, thereby hoping to draw sympathy from the Jews when they would then see Jesus' helpless condition. Bring him out and says, look at this, this is the man. This is the man here. The Roman scourging was the most severe and degrading form of torture. The person was stripped to the waist and tied to a post in a stooping position, and the back was then lacerated with a whip made of leather thongs, into which were tied bits of stone and metal, and weighed with lumps of lead at the tip of each thong. Some say it was called the cat of nine tails. The lash tore the skin and the muscles and exposed the bones on the back. Oftentimes the internal organs of the body were exposed, as the thongs were buried in the flesh on the sides and the underside of the body. And when the whip was dragged or yanked back, it tore the flesh wherever the whip was embedded. One soldier would whip until he was exhausted. Then another would take his place until it was determined that the victim had suffered enough. Sometimes the victim would die during this process and never make it to the cross. The psalmist describes the agony of Christ's suffering by saying in Psalm 129 and verse 3, quote, "The plowers plowed on my back. They made their furrows long," end of quote. Describing an agricultural thing of plowing the ground, that's what happened to Jesus when he was scourged. Now in verses 4 through 7, Pilate again goes outside to face the Jewish council and the mob that was forming. This time he brings Jesus out with him and announces that his verdict is the same. Jesus is innocent of all charges. Jesus appears wearing the crown and the robe. But instead of showing compassion for a severely wounded man, the Jewish leaders cry out for him to be crucified. In disdain and disgust for the Jews and their system, Pilate says, "You take him and crucify him. I find no fault in him." And the Jews replied that according to God's law, he's guilty of blasphemy in claiming to be the Son of God. And they are referring to Leviticus chapter 24 and verse 16. If you want to turn back there, let's do a little reference work in our Bibles. We'll be coming back to that passage, so hold your finger there. Leviticus 24:16 is what they are referring to. "And whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him, the stranger as well as him who is born in the land. And when he blasphemes the name of the Lord, he shall be put to death. So they're saying this is our law. And it was God's law. God gave this, the Mosaic law. Now in making this charge, the Jews used the term Son of God. This was said in our text to make Pilate even more afraid than he was. This tells us that Pilate is about to crack up now. Why so? In verses 8 through 11, we are told that Pilate, quote, went again into the praetorium, the courtroom, and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. He's troubled. This term, Son of God, where is this man come from to be given that title by the Jews? This is the third time now that Pilate has entered and re-entered the courtroom. So you see, there's time involved here in this. Now, many of the Roman officials were very superstitious, and Pilate would not be familiar with the expression Son of God in the biblical sense, but he would apply it to the gods, or what were known as divine men, who were believed to be gifted with supernatural powers. The Greeks and the Romans had all kinds of gods, and it was believed that they could make appearances and that these divine men had powers to work miracles. So Pilate's afraid. Was Jesus a man or a god? Where you come from? Who are you? This is Pilate's concern, since he has just what? Scourged a person who might be a god. Now when Jesus refused to answer him, Pilate charged him with contempt and disrespect toward the court. "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release?" Pilate's proud boast was not true. Jesus now speaks up and says, quote, "You have no power at all against me unless it has been given you from above." That could mean from my Father. Quote, "Therefore the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." We'll explain that in just a moment. Although Pilate was a responsible moral agent, responsible for his actions, he did not have absolute control over the events relating to the Son of God. I make this statement in passing. Nothing that happens is outside of the sovereignty of God. No matter what being, be it an angel or a man, who thinks that they are in control of what they're doing at any moment, they are deceived, because they will not be able to be doing what they're doing unless God has ordained that. God has not only ordained, though, good things, he's also ordained sinful things. But be they good or sinful, they're all under the control of God. And Pilate will be judged at the last day by the one that he is now judging. Let the advocates of free will emphasize all they want that man is responsible to God for his actions, and the evangelical Calvinists will agree. Until the Arminian says, God has done all he can do. The rest is up to you. In so doing, the Arminian is presenting a frustrated God who is limited by the will of man. Pilate is not messing up God's will and God's plan. Pilate was a sinful man. What he was doing was sinful with Jesus. But his sins, Brother Jim, did not keep God from fulfilling his purpose. Indeed, Pilate's actions put Jesus on the cross, where he fulfilled God's purpose in saving his people from their sins. God is always a step ahead of the actions of men. Though the wrong seems also strong, God is the ruler yet. Psalm 76:10 reigns true to this event in Pilate's life, quoting from the King James Version, "Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, and the remainder of wrath shall thou restrain." Proverbs 21:1, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turns it whithersoever he will." Herod, Pilate, the Jewish leaders, all the desires of their heart are just like a river or an irrigation channel. And God is turning it whichever way he wants. How many of you have ever seen a rice field and an irrigation channel? You ever seen one go up around Memphis, up between there and Jonesboro? You see all kinds, and you'll see the rivers flowing within their banks, but there will be little channels that the farmers have cut out, and they make those channels small, about that deep, about that wide, and they can block them off when they wish to. When they want the water to flow, they pull up those pieces of whatever wood or metal, and water flows out into the rice field. So they can take the water that comes out of the rivers and redistribute it wherever they want. That's what God does with the wrath of men. He can distribute it wherever that's going to lead to the fulfilling of his eternal purpose. That's the God that we have to deal with in sovereignty. Now think just a moment. If Pilate had been successful in his desire to release Jesus, then Christ would not have been crucified. And God's plan for the redemption of his people would have failed. Whose will was being done? The devil was doing his will. Men were doing their wills, and God was doing his will. Whose will was supreme? God. Only one, and that's God. God is never frustrated. Whose will is always supreme? God's will. Now let's go back to verses 12 through 15. Pilate now continues to persuade the Jews to drop their charges against Jesus. But they are now ready to play their trump card. These are shrewd men. In verse 12, we read, "From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, 'If you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend.' Whosoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." End of quote. Now the Jews had probably included this in their plot all along. They've got to get him crucified by the Romans. He can't escape. So if Pilate releases Jesus, the council, the Jewish council, will then go to Caesar and charge Pilate with being a traitor against Rome for releasing someone who he said was a rival king to Caesar. Get it? You release this king, we're going to go tell on you. You cannot be a friend to Caesar and allow a rival king to build up a kingdom in Rome. And the Jews replied, or rather Pilate concluded his case, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the Jews replied, "We have no king but Caesar." Let that sink in. If you know something about the Jews and their hatred for the Romans, we have no king but Caesar. We are loyal subjects. We are not insurrectionists, but you're letting an insurrectionist go. Caesar will have something to say about you and your job. Pilate now acknowledges his defeat and hands Jesus over to be crucified. This is the final step in the process of God, now listen, destroying the Jewish nation and turning it over, turning rather, to the Gentiles. We have no king. See what they are denying? They've been expecting a messianic king. We have no king but Caesar. It was described in summary in the prologue to John's Gospel in verses chapter 1, verses 11 and 12. These very familiar words, speaking of Christ, he came into his what? His own. And his own did not receive him. Now that means the Jewish nation, the Jewish people, the represent the nation. Picking it up again. But as many as received him. See, we have two owns here. His own people after the flesh, and his own people whom the Father has given to him. As many as believed, as received him, to them, listen, he gave the right or the power to become the children of God. Who has been the children of God up until now? The Jewish nation. That has now been taken away from them because of their statement here, and as many as receives Christ, to them they have the right to call themselves the people of God or the children of God. Who are those? Continue to quote again. To those who believe in his name. And who believes in his name? Quote again. Who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. It is this action here in before Pilate, we have no king, is the summation of what John is talking about at the beginning of his book. He came unto his own people, and his own people rejected him. There was no repentance when John the Baptist preached, nor when Jesus preached that the kingdom had come. When the Jews, as represented by their national leaders, rejected their king, the axe was laid to the roots of their national tree. Now, I have a vast majority disagree with what I'm just saying, but I stand by the position I hold to. It concerns whether or not God has any future dealings with the Jews as a nation. I maintain that when this happened, God took the axe to the tree and cut down the Jewish nation, never again to be restored. Amen. He's turning to the Gentiles. Their covenant, Brother Jim, with God was doomed.
That's right.
And God would be most righteous when just a few years later he would destroy the Jewish nation, the temple, and its priesthood, never to be restored. This would be at the hands of the Romans in 70 AD. Since that time, God, now listen, I'm wording it carefully, God has not imparted any spiritual blessings upon the unbelieving nation or any unbelieving Jewish individual. I carefully worded that. There is a Jewish nation over there in Palestine today. That is not there by the spiritual blessings of God. It may be there by the providence of God, but it is not God blessing them. God no longer blesses unbelievers as a race, as a people. He has now turned to a new covenant made with believing Jews, which comprise a remnant of God's, the remnant of God's elect. And these, along with believing Gentiles, make up what is called in Galatians 6:16, quote, the Israel of God. This is the new Israel, the remnant. Everyone who receives Jesus is part of this new people, be they Jew or Gentile. But the covenant that God made with them in the Old Testament era is over. Pilate's last act now in closing the trial. We must now return to the Gospel of Matthew. In Matthew 27, verses 24 through 25, we have the account of Pilate washing his hands so as to display that he is not responsible for the death of Jesus. Incidentally, this is the only time this is recorded. The other Gospels don't record this incident. Only Matthew does. And there we read, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, means a riot, he took water, washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I'm innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. That is, you accept the responsibility. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. We take responsibility. Now Pilate had become familiar with several of the Jewish laws and the ceremonies. And the hand washing ceremony was based on the Jewish law found in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 1 through 9. Since this is a long verse, and toward the end of our lesson, well, I turn there with you. Deuteronomy 21, verses 1 through 9. This will give us the background of what Pilate is doing. And there we read, beginning in verse 1, Deuteronomy 21. If anyone is found slain, lying in the field in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess, and it's not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance from the slain man to the surrounding cities. And it shall be that the elders of the city nearest to the slain man will take a heifer which has not been worked, and which has not pulled with a yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And by their word, every controversy and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of that city nearest to the slain man, now watch, shall wash their hands over the heifer, whose neck was broken in the valley. Then they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed. and do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. And the atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. End of quote. Sure helps to know our Old Testament.
Amen.
Pilate knew this verse. In essence, what this is describing, if a dead body was found in a field and the ruling elders of the nearest city were not able to determine who the murderer was, then the Mosaic law required that they could publicly wash their hands, then pray to God, and thereby absolve themselves of any guilt regarding their inability to solve the crime and render justice. The crime can't be solved. And we've tried. Pilate used the modified form of this Jewish ceremony to proclaim that he, Pilate, was innocent of this innocent man's blood. Pilate did not wish to see Jesus die, but he was not courageous enough to risk his job and his reputation to protect Christ's life. Isn't the Bible a marvelous piece
Amen.
Of work?
Amen.
Even the unregenerate, the wicked, use it to quote from it from time to time. Well, let's give a summary. The trial is over now. What will come next week is the path to Calvary, the path to the crucifixion, the events that occur there. But lest that this pass over or through our minds and not make the impact that it should, and we think, well, this is just a story about Pilate. He was quite a character. Brother Asa, how often we violate our own moral codes if our livelihood is threatened. Examples: lying in order to get a job, lying to hold on to a job, money talks. And individuals that are Christian find themselves in a dilemma from time to time. Am I going to stand by my moral convictions or am I going to lose my job? Another illustration. A minister who says he believes what the Bible teaches, but cannot teach what is in the Bible for fear of losing his pastorate. I've talked with men who said, yes, I believe what you believe, Jim, about God's sovereignty, but I can't preach that in my church. I'll lose my job. And I feel that I can at least do some good if I just remain quiet about this issue. I can do some good because I'll have some people to minister to, but if I lose my job, I won't have anybody. So wouldn't it be better for me to have some good for the kingdom than nothing? Sounds like Pilate, doesn't it? All of us, at some time or another, have tried to rationalize our behavior in order to protect our own self-interest. There remains too much of Pilate and Herod in all of us. You know what that's called? One little word, three letters. S-I-N. Sin. So lest that we just float through this event and say, well, that was just a man back there and he had his job at mine, but That doesn't have anything to do with me. It has everything to do with you and me. It's how we live up in our conscience toward our ethics and what we will compromise in order to maintain our livelihood and our reputations. We'll close there this morning.